and welcome to Greatest Britons. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. Today's Greatest Briton is Elizabeth I, and as always, my co-host for the series is Max Musson from Western Spring. Well, shall we get into our Greatest Britons for today then, Max?
Yes, let's do that.
Let's talk about a new Greatest Briton, a female Greatest Briton. We're going to be beginning a series today on Her Royal Highness Elizabeth I, the Virgin Queen, Good Queen Bess. She ruled alone for nearly half a century, lending her name to a glorious epoch in world history. She dazzled even her greatest enemies. Her sense of duty was admirable, although it came at great personal cost. She was committed above all else to preserving English peace and stability, and her genuine love for her subjects was legendary. Only a few years after her death in 1603, they were lamenting her passing, and in her greatest speech to Parliament, she told them, "I count the glory of my crown that I have reigned with your love." And 5 centuries later, the worldwide love affair with Elizabeth Tudor continues. She was born on the 7th of September 1533 and died on the 24th of March 1603, and she was the Queen of England and Ireland for 45 years, from the 17th of November 1558 until her death in 1603. Sometimes referred to as the Virgin Queen, Elizabeth was the last of the 5 monarchs of the House of Tudor, supposedly descended in part from the original pre-Saxon kingly lines of Britain. Elizabeth was the daughter of Henry VIII and Anne Boleyn, his second wife, who was executed when Elizabeth was just 2.5 years old. Anne's marriage to Henry was annulled, and Elizabeth was declared illegitimate. Her half-brother, Edward VI, ruled until his death in 1553, bequeathing the crown to Lady Jane Grey, an English noblewoman, and ignoring the claims of his 2 half-sisters, the Roman Catholic Mary and the younger Elizabeth. This was in spite of statute law to the contrary. Edward's will was set aside after 9 days, and Mary became queen, deposing Lady Jane Grey, and during Mary's reign, Elizabeth was imprisoned for nearly a year on suspicion of supporting Protestant rebels. Upon her half-sister's death in 1558, Elizabeth succeeded to the throne and set out to rule by good counsel. She depended heavily on a group of trusted advisers led by William Cecil, whom much later she created first Baron Burghley. One of her first actions as queen was the establishment of an English Protestant church, of which she became the supreme governor. This Elizabethan religious settlement was to evolve into the Church of England. It was expected that she would marry and produce an heir, however, despite numerous courtships, she never did, and she was eventually succeeded by her first cousin twice removed, James VI of Scotland, which laid the foundation for the Kingdom of Great Britain in 1707, which finally became the United Kingdom of Britain and Ireland in 1800. She had earlier been reluctantly responsible for the imprisonment and execution of James's mother, Mary, Queen of Scots, for plotting to assassinate her. She loved all kinds of sports, especially horse riding, and in the early years of her reign spent many an hour riding. She also loved hunting, hawking, bear baiting, and watching the male courtiers excel at jousts or other sporting contests. She loved music and dancing, pageantry and masks, and could even play the virginals and the lute herself with skill. She had no time for the Puritan theologians who deemed such things impious. She also loved watching plays and created the atmosphere responsible for the flourishing of the literary masterpieces of the period, against the Puritan demands for the closure of all theatres and playhouses. And this was the time of Shakespeare. In government, she was more moderate than her father and half-siblings had been, with one of her mottos being "Video et tacio," I see and keep silent. In religion, she was relatively tolerant and avoided systematic persecution, but after the Pope declared her illegitimate in 1570 and released her subjects from obedience to her, several conspiracies threatened her life, all of which were defeated with the help of her minister's secret service that was run by Francis Walsingham. Elizabeth was cautious in foreign affairs, manoeuvring between the major powers of France and Spain, and she only half-heartedly supported a number of ineffective, poorly resourced military campaigns in the Netherlands, France, and Ireland. As she grew older, she became celebrated for her virginity, and a cult of personality grew around her, which was celebrated in the portraits, pageants, and literature of the day. Her reign became known as the Elizabethan era. The period is famous for the flourishing of English drama led by playwrights such as William Shakespeare and Christopher Marlowe, and for the prowess of English maritime adventurers such as Francis Drake and Walter Raleigh. Some historians depict Elizabeth as a short-tempered, sometimes indecisive ruler who enjoyed more than her fair share of luck. Towards the end of her reign, a series of economic and military problems weakened her popularity. However, Elizabeth is acknowledged as a charismatic performer and a dogged survivor in an era where government was ramshackle and limited, and when monarchs in neighbouring countries faced internal problems that jeopardised their thrones. After the short reigns of her half-siblings, her 44 years on the throne provided welcome stability for the kingdom and helped to forge a sense of national identity. And I think that's really true. You've got somebody on the throne for 44 years, and you've got everybody sort of working to advance the cause of Britain and to advance her cause. You've got these adventurers going out there, discovering America, settling America. And at the same time, you've got all these great plays that are being produced. And you haven't got democracy in the form that we have it now. She was still very important in the role that she played. But at the same time, she, as she said, I see, but I keep silent. So her influence on things wasn't in the same way that a male king would have been. I think she sort of took a little step back from things. And I think it must have been pretty shocking to lose her mother at 2.5 years old. And she had quite a hard life, as we'll see as we get into this. You got any thoughts on that, Max?
Well, I would just like to say, really, that there are three women in British history that I think stand out above all the others. One is Boadicea. The other one is Ethelfled, who is the daughter of Alfred the Great, the Lady of Wessex, who effectively was a monarch in her own right, and Elizabeth I, who repelled the Spanish Armada, or was queen at the time when the Spanish Armada was repelled. Perhaps that's a better way of saying it. All three of these are women who rose to the very highest level during a time when women were supposed to be unable to do that sort of thing. And what they've actually shown, what those three women showed in becoming monarchs and absolute monarchs, effectively, is that where women have the correct character and the correct abilities, then there has never been anything to stop them from rising to the highest levels. There is no glass ceiling as far as they're concerned. And if anybody thinks that Elizabeth I had it easy because she was, you know, born the daughter of Henry VIII, she didn't have it easy. There was all sorts of palace intrigues and things where people were trying, and foreign powers were trying to assassinate her, and people even within Britain were trying to assassinate her. And she is somebody who triumphed nonetheless, and so I've got a great deal of admiration for her.
Oh, she became a great inspiration for the British people. I mean, you can really see that by the imagery and the iconography that surrounds her. Well, let's start with a look at her early life. Elizabeth was 2 years and 8 months old when her mother was beheaded on the 19th of May 1536, 4 months after Catherine of Aragon's death from natural causes. Elizabeth was declared illegitimate and deprived of her place in the royal succession. 11 days after Anne Boleyn's execution, Henry married Jane Seymour. Queen Jane died the next year, shortly after the birth of their son Edward, who was the undisputed heir apparent to the throne. Elizabeth was placed in her half-brother's household and carried the chrism, or baptismal cloth, at his christening. There are two things I want to pick up on. That is just the fact that even if you're royalty, your children are still going to die. This wasn't something that just happened to the poor. Children would die, women would die in childbirth, and there was problems even with royal succession. And the second thing was this chrism, or baptismal cloth. That's something to do with the Orthodox Church, I think, more so than the Catholic Church, and that shows our history with the Orthodox Church as well as with the Catholic, and this is before the Protestants. And again, it must have been absolutely hideous for her to see that her mother was beheaded when she was 2.5 years old. I mean, I don't know if she saw that, but she certainly would have known of that, that it was the state that beheaded her mother, and she was destined to be the head of state herself.
Yeah.
And you just imagine what effect that would have had on her. By the time she was 11 years of age, she could write in English, Latin, and Italian. Under Grindel, a talented and skillful tutor, she also progressed in French and Greek. By the age of 12, she was able to translate her stepmother Catherine Parr's religious work, Prayers or Meditations, from English into Italian, Latin, and French, which she presented to her father as a New Year's gift. From her teenage years and throughout her life, she translated works in Latin and Greek by numerous classical authors, including the Pro Marcello of Cicero, the De Consolation Philosophy of Boethius, a treatise by Plutarch, and the Annals of Tacitus. A translation of Tacitus from Lambeth Palace Library, one of only four surviving English translations from the early modern era, was confirmed as Elizabeth's own in 2019, after a detailed analysis of the handwriting and paper was undertaken. This seems to me to be a continuation of a tradition started by Alfred the Great for translating things from Latin into English. And she's obviously very well educated, so she must have been a high IQ. I mean, it must have been good genes that she was bequeathed by her ancestors. This shows us that the royalty had good genes at the time. After Grindel died in 1548, Elizabeth received her education under her brother Edward's tutor, Roger Ascham, a sympathetic teacher who believed that learning should be engaging. Current knowledge of Elizabeth's schooling and precocity comes largely from Ascham's memories. By the time her formal education ended in 1550, aged 17, Elizabeth was one of the best educated women of her generation. At the end of her life, she was believed to speak the Welsh, Cornish, Scottish, and Irish languages in addition to those already mentioned. The Venetian ambassador stated in 1603 that she possessed these languages so thoroughly that each appeared to be her native tongue. And that's quite incredible. 7 or 8 different languages that she could speak there by the time she was 17. No, 4 or 5 by the time of 17, and then Welsh, Cornish, and Scottish, and Irish, as she got older. After Henry died, and her half brother was made king, Henry's widow Catherine Parr married Thomas Seymour, the brother of Lord Protector Eric Seymour. Elizabeth was taken in by them and possibly put off men for life by him. He engaged in romps and horseplay with the 14-year-old Elizabeth, including entering her bedroom in his nightgown, tickling her and slapping her on the buttocks. In response to this, Elizabeth would rise early and surrounded herself with maids to avoid his unwelcome morning visits. Parr, rather than confront her husband over his inappropriate activities, joined in. Twice she accompanied him in tickling Elizabeth and once held her while he cut her black gown into 1,000 pieces. However, after she discovered the pair in an embrace, she ended this state of affairs, and in May 1548, Elizabeth was sent away. And, I mean, it sort of comes across there as if he's abusing her, as if she wasn't liking this, but then it says that they were discovered in an embrace. So, I mean, I don't know, this is the first I've actually heard of this. Max, have you heard of this at all, of Elizabeth I? And this?
No, I haven't heard of this either, so... It's new for me.
You don't think of a future queen being treated in this way, basically. Thomas Seymour nevertheless continued scheming to control the royal family and tried to have himself appointed the governor of the king's person. When Parr died after childbirth on the 5th of September 1548, he renewed his attentions towards Elizabeth, intent on marrying her, and her governess Cat Ashley, who was fond of Seymour, sought to convince Elizabeth to take him as her husband. She tried to convince Elizabeth to write to Seymour and comfort him in his sorrow, but Elizabeth claimed that Thomas was not so saddened by her stepmother's death as to need comfort. So it seems as if she wasn't interested in him. She was rejecting him. And the fact she never did marry does tend to sort of say that she was put off men for life by him, really. In January, don't you think?
Yeah, quite possibly, yeah.
In January 1549, Seymour was arrested and imprisoned in the Tower on suspicion of conspiring to depose his brother Somerset as protector, marry Lady Jane Grey to King Edward VI, and take Elizabeth as his own wife. Elizabeth, living at Hatfield House, would admit nothing. Her stubbornness exasperated her interrogator, Sir Robert Tyrwhitt, who reported, "I do see it in her face that she is guilty." And Seymour was beheaded on the 20th of March, 1549. So I think we can see here that women were seen as a way to the top, and they would be exchanged in marriage, almost seen as a business transaction. And you can see here that he wanted to take her as his wife. And she was actually, there were all these princes on the continent that wanted to marry her so that they could have an alliance with Britain, basically. And I think this goes back millennia to seal an alliance with another country in Egypt. The pharaoh would marry one of the princesses from that other country, and also in the Hittite Empire. It's a very old tradition, and the same tradition is still going on in the 16th century here. So it's not just conspiracies of murdering people, but also conspiracies of taking somebody and marrying them and almost forcing them to marry them. I guess it's the same as when invading armies would take women as booty and take the wives of other people and take them as booty. And you always think, well, wouldn't the wife, you know, not be happy about that? Wouldn't she not serve her new husband? But apparently, I think they were just brought up that you had to serve your husband. He was your lord and master if you married him. And I think the same, you know, the same goes for royalty. They were told who they have to marry. Do you think?
I don't know that necessarily need be the case, but I certainly think as far as royal weddings are concerned, royal weddings were systematically used to cement alliances between noble families and that's been going on probably since the beginning of time, and probably still goes on to some extent today with the daughters of wealthy business people who wish to expand their business empire, marrying their daughters off to perhaps a rival or something of that sort, so that the two businesses will ultimately be united under one. Child or whatever.
Well, I think also you got the fact that Prince Charles, I mean, he was always involved with Camilla Parker Bowles, wasn't he? And yet he had to marry Lady Diana when really he wanted to be with Camilla Parker Bowles. So it sort of tends to imply that a similar sort of thing is still going on to this day. Well, Edward VI died on the 6th of July, 1553, aged 15. His will ignored the succession to the Crown Act of 1543 and excluded both Mary and Elizabeth from the succession, and instead declared as his heir Lady Jane Grey, the granddaughter of Henry VIII's younger sister, Mary. Jane was proclaimed Queen by the Privy Council, but her support quickly crumbled and she was deposed after just 9 days. And on the 3rd of August 1553, Mary rode triumphantly into London with Elizabeth at her side. But the show of solidarity between the sisters did not last long. Mary, a devout Catholic, was determined to crush the Protestant faith in which Elizabeth had been educated, and she ordered that everyone must attend Catholic Mass. Elizabeth had to outwardly conform, but Mary's initial popularity ebbed away in 1554 when she announced plans to marry Philip of Spain, the son of the Holy Roman Emperor Charles V, and an active Catholic. Discontent spread rapidly through the country, and many looked to Elizabeth as a focus for their opposition to Mary's religious policies. In January and February 1554, Wyatt's Rebellion broke out, with protesters demanding that Mary must marry someone English, and it was soon suppressed. Elizabeth was brought to court and interrogated regarding her role, and on the 18th of March she was imprisoned in the Tower of London, fervently protesting her innocence. Although it is unlikely that she plotted with the rebels, some of them were known to have approached her. Mary's closest confidant, Charles V's ambassador, Simon Renard, argued that Mary's throne would never be safe while Elizabeth lived, and Lord Chancellor Stephen Gardiner worked to have Elizabeth put on trial. But Elizabeth's supporters in the government, including William Paget, the first Baron Paget, convinced Mary to spare her sister in the absence of hard evidence against her. And instead, on the 22nd of May, Elizabeth was moved from the Tower to Woodstock, where she was to spend almost a year under house arrest in the charge of Sir Henry Bedingfield. As a measure of the support there was for her already at this time, crowds cheered her all along the way. So, you know, royalty, you know, they get put in prison, they get beheaded. I mean, it's a pretty it's a pretty risky business to be in. You know, people think royalty, you know, they're rich, they have everything that they asked for, and yet they run all these risks of this intrigue that goes on. On the 17th,
news of their fame, etc., was in those days spread by travelling musicians who would travel from pub to pub or inn to inn and would sing songs telling the stories of the monarchs and the various people at court, and some of the songs would have been humorous and some of them wouldn't, but it would appear that a lot of people had sung about Elizabeth, so that she was very famous by this point.
Yeah, it's a good point. Without the media, and if you weren't actually living in London, how would you find all this out from the wandering minstrels? On the 17th of April 1555, Elizabeth was recalled to court to attend the final stages of Mary's apparent pregnancy. If Mary and her child died, Elizabeth would become queen. But if Mary gave birth to a healthy child, Elizabeth's chances of becoming queen would recede sharply. When it became clear that Mary was in fact not pregnant, no one believed any longer that she could have a child, as she was too old, and Elizabeth's succession now seemed assured. Mary recognised Elizabeth as her heir on the 6th of November 1558, and Elizabeth became queen when Mary finally died on the 17th of November. So it seems as if the British public knew that she was eventually going to be queen, and they realised that she was going to be a good queen a long time before she was actually crowned. Elizabeth became queen at the age of 25 and declared her intentions to her council and other peers who had come to Hatfield to swear allegiance. The speech contains a reference to the requirement to do our duty for our posterity, not anyone else's posterity. And she said, "My lords, the law of nature moves me to sorrow for my sister. The burden that is fallen upon me makes me amazed, and yet, considering I am God's creature, ordained to obey his appointment, I will thereto yield, desiring from the bottom of my heart that I may have assistance of his grace to be the minister of his heavenly will in this office now committed to me. And as I am but one body naturally considered, though by his permission a body politic to govern, so shall I desire you all to be assistant to me, that I with my ruling and you with your service may make a good account to Almighty God and leave some comfort to our posterity on earth. I mean to direct all my actions by good advice and counsel." So I think that makes it, that highlights the importance there. Everything was geared towards improving the lives of the people that were to come after, in the same way that the people that had come before had dedicated their lives to doing the same thing and trying to improve the life of the British nation. As her triumphal progress wound through the city on the eve of the coronation ceremony, she was welcomed wholeheartedly by the citizens and greeted by orations and pageants, most with a strong Protestant favour, and on the following day she was crowned and anointed by Owen Oglethorpe, the Catholic Bishop of Carlisle in Westminster Abbey. She was then presented for the people's acceptance amidst a deafening noise of organs, fifes, trumpets, drums and bells. And that really must have been quite something to see. I should imagine this coronation went on for a few days with feasts and all the rest of it, an announcement going on throughout the country. So she's made a decision that the way that she's going to govern, she's going to listen to good advice, good counsel, and she's going to do everything she can to improve the comfort of our posterity, not her individual posterity, but our posterity of the people that were in the country at the time. And as we will see as we get into this, you know, she did really well at that. Well, should we go back in the past then to better times? Should we talk about our greatest Britons, Max?
Let's do that, yes.
Yeah, let's talk about Elizabeth I. And in the last episode, we heard how traumatic Elizabeth's early life was, with her mother being beheaded and her adopted father trying to take advantage of her. She was a keen student, learning to speak a number of languages in her youth and translating works from Greek and Latin. Her Catholic sister was eventually made queen, but the public had more support for Elizabeth. And when Mary died without providing an heir, Elizabeth was finally made queen. In her coronation speech, she made mention of intending to do whatever she could to provide comfort to the posterity of her nation, showing an understanding of her role to improve conditions for the next generation born to her ethnicity. And I thought that was very important, the wording that she used, that the posterity of the nation. So it shows that talking about ethnicity, and ethnicity does come into the story later on here as well, as we will see. Is there anything else you want to bring up or remember about Elizabeth I before we start, Max?
No, I don't think so. I mean, posterity obviously meaning the future generations of our kind, and so the use of words like posterity there are significant.
Yeah, it's a great word to use. We find that used in the American Constitution as well, and abused today to say that it actually means everyone. It doesn't. It means the next generations born to you. Well, Elizabeth's personal religious convictions have been much debated by scholars. She was a Protestant, but kept Catholic symbols such as the crucifix and downplayed the role of sermons in defiance of a key Protestant belief. Elizabeth and her advisers perceived the threat of a Catholic crusade against heretical England, and the Queen therefore sought a Protestant solution that would not offend Catholics too greatly while addressing the desires of the English Protestants. The one thing she would not do, though, is tolerate the Puritans, who were pushing for far-reaching reforms. As a result, the Parliament of 1559 started to legislate for a church based on the Protestant settlement of Edward VI, with the monarch as its head, but with many Catholic elements, such as vestments. All public officials were now to swear an oath of loyalty to the monarch as the supreme governor of the church, or risk disqualification from office, while the heresy laws were repealed to avoid a repeat of the persecution of dissenters that was practiced by Mary. So this was very diplomatic of her, basically. She's getting everybody to take an oath to her, because, of course, the Catholics, they're loyal to the pontiff, and this was the source of the problems, really, was this loyalty to the Pope instead of loyalty to the monarch. And it's good that she's refusing to tolerate the Puritans, who were the ones that wanted to smash everything up, basically. The early Bolsheviks, I think the Puritans were, caused all sorts of problems in Ireland, caused all sorts of problems in the Reformation. And yeah, she would not tolerate these Puritans. And she's keeping some of the trappings of the church so that it still looks the same, but slowly moving it into Protestantism, and with her at the head of it. Even though, I mean, the monarch may not know that much about religion, I guess that was a response to the Catholic being the Pope being the head of the Catholic Church, which was seen as an international institution by this time that was interfering with the sovereignty of other nations, rather than being something that was separate from other nations. And there was this dislike of Mary because of the way that she treated the Catholics. And that was one of the reasons why people wanted to see Elizabeth on the throne, because they thought that she would be a little bit milder and try to bring the two sides together, which I think she really succeeded in doing. And if you know much about this time, Max, do you want to add any comments to that?
I'm not particularly knowledgeable about this time, other than that the Puritans were very straight-laced. The Puritans, from what I can recall, didn't like great ornamentation. They wanted their churches to be very simple affairs. They were fairly sort of dour and what's the word I'm thinking of here? Dour and humorless in many respects, and they also had some quite sort of bizarre names for people, and so I can remember reading that there was a person who was called In Pieces Before the Lord. That was his name, and things like that. And they, I think the early Puritans used to interpret the Bible absolutely literally, and that tended to cause problems as well.
Yeah, I think they tried to ban Christmas. You say they didn't like the merrymaking. Yeah, they tried to ban Christmas, that's right, and dancing and all sorts. Yeah, real killjoys they were. Well, marriage negotiations constituted a key element in Elizabeth's foreign policy, and she turned down many requests after serious negotiations, once telling an imperial envoy, "If I follow the inclination of my nature, it is this, beggar woman and single, far rather than queen and married." And she must have been highly sought after as somebody to marry, being the Queen of England. And I guess there must have been a lot of machinations as well, trying to get her to marry somebody from a certain country so that they would get favour. The people from that country would then get favour in England. In 1570, senior figures in the government privately accepted that Elizabeth would never marry or name a successor. And for her failure to marry, Elizabeth was often accused of irresponsibility. Her silence, however, strengthened her own political security, for she knew that if she named an heir, her throne would be vulnerable to a coup. She remembered the way that a second person, as I have been, had been used as the focus of plots against her predecessor. And she was. They tried to implicate her in all sorts of plots to get rid of Mary and put Elizabeth on the throne. And people tried to marry her as well, didn't they, before then? And there was somebody that was put to death for plotting a coup. Elizabeth's unmarried status inspired a cult of virginity related to that of the Virgin Mary, and in poetry and portraiture, she was depicted as a virgin or a goddess or both, not as a normal woman. At first, only Elizabeth made a virtue of her ostensible virginity, and in 1559 she told the commons, "And in the end this shall be for me sufficient, that a marble stone shall declare that a queen, having reigned such a time, lived and died a virgin." Later on, poets and writers took up the theme and developed an iconography that exalted Elizabeth, and ultimately she would insist that she was married to her kingdom and subjects, and because of that, under divine protection. In 1599 she spoke of "all my husbands, all my good people." And I mean, this is long been associated with the king or the queen, that they're actually married to the kingdom and married to their subjects. And she was sort of putting this quite literally. And I do think it's interesting that she was a virgin. It's quite kind of like having a nun as the queen. And she really does stand out throughout the whole of history for this, I think. Have you got any comments on it, Max?
I think some people have suggested that she did actually have affairs, but never became pregnant. That's a possibility. But I think that one of the things that she appears to have done is to, as you say, have projected this this image of herself as being almost otherworldly and almost in her position by divine right. And she developed this way of dressing with, you know, what was quite obviously power dressing, with the enormous ornate frilly collars to her dresses, the tight bodices, the very voluminous skirts, the fact that her hair was all sort of piled up on top of her head with various adornments, etc., and the fact that she used to whiten her skin to make herself look you know, somewhat otherworldly as well. So it was power dressing at its sort of 16th century peak, I think.
Yeah, these images of her as well, they weren't quite realistic. They tended to exaggerate these features and make her look mysterious and supernatural. So I guess at the time she would have worn makeup as well to accentuate that. Well, Mary, Queen of Scots, caused problems for her, as the Catholics wanted to put her on the throne. Mary was Elizabeth's cousin, and Elizabeth moved quickly to try and get her married off to someone who would not be a threat to her own rule. And in 1563, Elizabeth proposed her own suitor, Robert Dudley, as a husband for Mary, without asking either of the two people concerned. Predictably, both proved unenthusiastic, and in 1565, Mary married Henry Stuart, Lord Darnley, who carried his own claim to the English throne. Again, it's interesting here. It means that basically, if you're the monarch, you can order somebody underneath you to marry who you want them to marry. So it shows that marriage was seen more like a business transaction or something for a dynastic transaction to ensure dynastic succession and to make certain that you had the person on the throne that you wanted. This is why they wanted Elizabeth to marry certain people, because they wanted an alliance between Britain and some of these other countries on the continent. This marriage was the first of a series of errors of judgment by Mary that handed the victory to the Scottish Protestants and to Elizabeth. Darnley quickly became unpopular and was murdered in February 1567 by conspirators, almost certainly led by James Hepburn, the 4th Earl of Bothwell. Shortly afterwards, on the 15th of May 1567, Mary married Bothwell, arousing suspicions that she had been party to the murder of her husband. Elizabeth confronted Mary about the marriage, writing to her, "How could a worse choice be made for your honour than in such haste to marry such a subject, who besides other and notorious lacks, public fame has charged with the murder of your late husband, besides the touching of yourself also in some part, though we trust in that behalf falsely." These events led rapidly to Mary's defeat and imprisonment in Loch Leven Castle. The Scottish lords forced her to abdicate in favour of her son James VI, who had been born in June 1566, who was then taken to Stirling Castle to be raised as a Protestant. Mary escaped from Loch Leven in 1568, but after another defeat, fled across the border into England, where she had once been assured of support from Elizabeth. Elizabeth's first instinct was to restore her fellow monarch, but she and her council instead chose to play safe. Rather than risk returning Mary to Scotland with an English army or sending her to France and the Catholic enemies of England, they detained her in England, where she was imprisoned for the next 19 years. Mary soon became the focus for rebellion, and in 1569 there was a major Catholic rising in the north, and the goal was to free Mary, marry her to Thomas Howard, 4th Duke of Norfolk, and put her on the English throne. After the rebels' defeat, over 750 of them were executed on Elizabeth's orders, but in the belief that the revolt had been successful, Pope Pius V issued a bull in 1570 titled Regnans in Excelsis, which declared Elizabeth, the pretended Queen of England and the servant of crime, to be excommunicated and a heretic, releasing all her subjects from any allegiance to her. Catholics who obeyed her orders were threatened with excommunication. This papal bull provoked legislative initiatives against Catholics by Parliament, which were, however, mitigated by Elizabeth's own intervention. In 1581, to convert English subjects to Catholicism with the intent to withdraw them from their allegiance to Elizabeth was made a treasonable offence, carrying the death penalty. From the 1570s, missionary priests from the continental seminaries were sent to England secretly in the cause of the reconversion of England, and many suffered execution, engendering a cult of martyrdom around them. Regnans in Excelsis gave English Catholics a strong incentive to look to Mary Stuart as the legitimate sovereign of England. Mary may not have been told of every Catholic plot to put her on the English throne, but from the Ridolfi plot of 1571, which caused Mary's suitor, the Duke of Norfolk, to lose his head, to the Babington plot of 1586, Elizabeth's spymaster, Sir Francis Walsingham, and the Royal Council keenly assembled a case against her. At first, Elizabeth resisted calls for Mary's death, but by late 1586, she had been persuaded to sanction her trial and execution on the evidence of letters written during the Babington plot. Elizabeth's proclamation of the sentence announced that the said Mary, pretending title to the same crown, had compassed and imagined within the same realm diverse things, tending to the hurt, death, and destruction of our royal person. On the 8th of February 1587, Mary was beheaded at Fotheringay Castle, Northamptonshire. After the execution, Elizabeth claimed that she had not intended for the signed execution warrant to be dispatched and blamed her secretary, William Davison, for implementing it without her knowledge. the sincerity of Elizabeth's remorse and whether or not she wanted to delay the warrant have been called into question both by her contemporaries and by later historians. Well, she does seem to be merciful there, doesn't she? She intervenes to prevent people being executed in that first plot, but then Mary just turned out to be too dangerous to have around, and the Pope really didn't help by telling all the Catholics that they should no longer be obeying Elizabeth, and Elizabeth was a heretic. So you can see the Pope interfering there, and this is the sort of reason why we stopped being Catholic. You know, a lot of people.
And Mary persistently manoeuvred to try and pair up with somebody else who had a claim to the English throne. So she, this was the third time she'd blotted a copybook, and so on that basis you can understand why Elizabeth had lost her patience with her.
Yeah, it's quite obvious what she was doing, marrying somebody with a claim to the English throne. Well, Elizabeth's foreign policy was largely defensive. The exception was with the English occupation of Le Havre from October 1562 to June 1563, which ended in failure when Elizabeth's Huguenot allies joined with the Catholics to retake the port. Elizabeth's intention had been to exchange Le Havre for Calais, lost to France in January 1558. Only through the activities of her fleets did Elizabeth pursue an aggressive policy, and this paid off in the war against Spain, 80% of which was fought at sea. She knighted Francis Drake after his circumnavigation of the globe from 1577 to 1580, and he won fame for his raids on Spanish ports and fleets. An element of piracy and self-enrichment drove the Elizabethan seafarers, over whom the Queen had little control. And there was a lot of piracy that was going on at the time. I mean, it might be worth looking at Francis Drake at some point here. And again, this shows that we used to have parts of France, quite a few parts of France used to be managed by the King of England. And the problem was, because the King was in England, he would lose his claim in France, and then he'd have to raise an army, pay the taxes to pay the army, and then he'd have to go over to France, fight the war, secure the area again so that he was the sovereign again, and then there'd be a rebellion back in England, and he'd have to come back to England, and then he'd lose his properties in France. And this went on and on and on, and the public would be taxed every time in order to pay for these wars, and eventually we lost all our properties in France. But that's why Brittany is still called Brittany. But at one point, we had quite a few parts in France.
Not really from the Channel Islands. We've still got the Channel Islands, which which are the last lingering little pieces of land.
Yeah, Jersey, Guernsey, and the Isle of Sark. Well, so Francis Drake had undertaken a major voyage against Spanish ports and ships in the Caribbean in 1585 and 1586. And in 1587, he made a successful raid on Cadiz, destroying the Spanish fleet of warships intended for the enterprise of England, just at the same time that Philip II of Spain had decided to take the war to England. On 12th of July 1588, the Spanish Armada, a great fleet of ships, set sail for the Channel, planning to ferry a Spanish invasion force under the Duke of Parma to the coast of southeast England from the Netherlands. A combination of miscalculation, misfortune, and an attack of English fireships on the 29th of July off Gravelines, which dispersed the Spanish ships to the northeast, defeated the Armada, and the Armada straggled home to Spain in shattered remnants after disastrous losses on the coast of Ireland, after some ships had tried to struggle back to Spain via the North Sea and then back south past the west coast of Ireland. And I have heard that this was really down to a freak of the weather. I mean, they're talking about these fire ships that were sent off, but the winds must have blown them towards the Spanish ships, and also that a lot of these ships ended up getting wrecked at the time, if I remember. And wasn't this when Francis Drake was playing bowls on the ship, I believe?
There was a famous incident where Francis Drake was supposed to be playing bowls as the Armada sort of came over the horizon. From my recollection of history, that there was a distinct difference between the British ships, which became nicknamed the Wooden Wolves and the Spanish ships, which were much larger, but which had a very broad draft and had very flat bottoms, because the Spanish were used to using those kind of ships in the Mediterranean, where there is very little in terms of rough sea. But once they got to the coasts of Britain and within sort of spitting distance of Britain, the seas obviously were a lot more choppy. And the difference in between the Spanish ships and the British ships was that the British ships were narrower and smaller, but they had much deeper keels so that they were stable in the rough sea, which then meant that we could fire cannons far more accurately at the Spanish ships, whereas the Spanish ships, because of their flat bottoms, were rocking from side to side. So half the time they'd fire and their cannonballs would go like sort of straight up in the air, whereas the other half of the time their cannons pointing down towards the sea. And so that they were at a distinct disadvantage in terms of their stability in rough seas.
I did hear there was some problems when the seamen got back as well with actually being paid their wages. There was a bit of upset about this. Well, unaware of the Armada's fate, the English militias mustered to defend the country under the Earl of Leicester's command, and he invited Elizabeth to inspect her troops at Tilbury in Essex on the 8th of August. Wearing a silver breastplate over a white velvet dress, she addressed them in one of her most famous speeches. "My loving people, we have been persuaded by some that are careful of our safety to take heed how we commit ourselves to armed multitudes for fear of treachery. But I assure you, I do not desire to live to distrust my faithful and loving people. I know I have the body but of a weak and feeble woman, but I have the heart and stomach of a king, and of a king of England too, and I think foul scorn that Parma or Spain or any prince of Europe should dare to invade the borders of my realm." When no invasion came, the nation rejoiced, and Elizabeth's procession to a Thanksgiving service at St. Paul's Cathedral rivaled that of her coronation as a spectacle. The defeat of the Armada was a potent propaganda victory, both for Elizabeth and for her Protestant England. The English took their delivery as a symbol of God's favour and of the nation's inviolability under a virgin queen. However, the victory was not a turning point in the war, which continued and often favoured Spain. The Spanish still controlled the southern provinces of the Netherlands, and the threat of invasion remained. Sir Walter Raleigh claimed after her death that Elizabeth's caution had actually impeded the war against Spain. He said, "If the late Queen would have believed her men of war as she did her scribes, we had in her time beaten that great empire into pieces and made their kings of figs and oranges as in old times. But Her Majesty did all by halves, and by petty invasions taught the Spaniard how to defend himself and to see his own weakness." So a little bit of bitterness there from Sir Walter Raleigh. I don't know if there was any personal animosity there against her. Though some historians have criticised Elizabeth on similar grounds, Raleigh's verdict has more often been judged unfair. Elizabeth had good reason not to place too much trust in her commanders, who once in action tended, as she put it herself, to be transported with a haviour of vain glory. So they thought that they were much better than they actually were. I think we had that same accusation as well at other points when we had the British Empire. In 1589, the year after the Spanish Armada, Elizabeth sent to Spain the English Armada, or the Counter Armada, with 23,375 men and 150 ships, led by Sir Francis Drake as Admiral and Sir John Norreys as General. The English fleet suffered a catastrophic defeat, with 11,000 to 15,000 killed, wounded or died of disease, and 40 ships sunk or captured. The advantage England had won upon the destruction of the Spanish Armada was lost, and the Spanish victory marked a revival of Philip II's naval power through the next decade. And I think that ties in with the fact that that the sailors weren't paid after that first one. And then when they sent out this second one, they ended up losing, not too good. Then we move into Ireland. Although Ireland was one of her two kingdoms, Elizabeth faced a hostile and in places virtually autonomous Irish population that adhered to Catholicism and was willing to defy her authority and plot with her enemies. Her policy there was to grant land to her courtiers and prevent the rebels from giving Spain a base from which to attack England. In the course of a series of uprisings, Crown forces pursued scorched earth tactics, burning the land and slaughtering man, woman, and child. During a revolt in Munster led by Gerald Fitzgerald, 14th Earl of Desmond, in 1582, an estimated 30,000 Irish people starved to death. The poet and colonist Edwin Spencer wrote that the victims were brought to such wretchedness as that any stony heart would have rued the same. Elizabeth advised her commanders that the Irish, that rude and barbarous nation, be well treated, but she or her commanders showed no remorse when putting down rebellions. Between 1594 and 1603, Elizabeth faced her most severe test in Ireland during the Nine Years' War, a revolt that took place at the height of hostilities with Spain, who backed the rebel leader Hugh O'Neill, Earl of Tyrone. In spring of 1599, Elizabeth sent Robert Devereux, 2nd Earl of Essex, to put the revolt down, but to her frustration, he made little progress and returned to England in defiance of her orders. He was replaced by Charles Blount, Lord Mountjoy, who took 3 years to defeat the rebels, and O'Neill finally surrendered in 1603, a few days after Elizabeth's death. Soon after, a peace treaty was signed between England and Spain. And I think Ireland always provided problems as well. They were the last to receive help to actually improve the country after Wales and Scotland. They were always seen as like the last place that the King of England wanted to go to, even though it was supposedly the King of England's realm. But a lot of the time, as it says here, it was virtually autonomous. And when the English would go over there, they would just end up having fights with the Irish. But the problem was, with a nation like that that was rebelling against the king, they could allow the Spanish in there, and then you'd have the Spanish and the Irish against the English.
I think that reflects a lack of statesmanship, really, on the part of Elizabeth. The fact of the matter is, if you've got a nation that's composed of certain factions that don't readily support you, then part of the solution to that is that you've got to concentrate on winning their hearts, basically, and also of securing the land. You know, and you mentioned about how we still controlled parts of France in those days. Well, the way in which those sort of issues were sorted out by the Romans, for example, was that they would create garrison towns all along the furthest borders of their empire, and you know, that set an example for other powers following the fall of the Roman Empire. But and that's really what should have been done by Elizabeth. She should have created garrison towns all along the border of in France, where her realm ended, in order to prevent that sort of thing. And so and she needed to make sure that those garrison towns were led by people that she could trust to be loyal to her. And the same thing should have been done in Ireland. They should have had, you know, Ireland should have had a number of garrison towns, particularly around the western border of Ireland, where it's abuts to the sea, in order to prevent the Spanish from coming ashore. And that's obviously something that she failed to do.
Yeah, I think that's something Edward I did when he was in France, built lots of new towns and actually developed new settlements. But again, he failed to do that in Ireland. He failed to do what he'd done in France in Ireland. I think all the monarchs did, really. They just ended up trying to force the Irish to do what they wanted them to do with weapons, instead of helping them out with investment.
And the other thing to have done as well would have been to have created a capital city for the British Isles in Ireland. If you create your capital city in the part of your realm which is least loyal to you, then that very fact that you've done that will help to strengthen your realm and your lands by virtue of the fact that the people who have tended to trust you least will, through constant contact with you, come to trust you more, and it will create a much more stable country.
Yeah, I think, again, I think the problem was just getting enough people over there to do something like that and paying them. I mean, Ireland was part of the British realm on paper, but I think most of the time it was just ungovernable because everybody was in England, Scotland and Wales, and they had enough problems with Scotland and Wales. By the time they managed to get rid of them and try to get over to Ireland, they'd run out of funds to pay these armies that they had. Well, moving to Russia, Elizabeth continued to maintain the diplomatic relations with the Tsardom of Russia that were originally established by her half-brother, Edward VI. She often wrote to Ivan the Terrible on amicable terms, although the Tsar was often annoyed by her focus on commerce rather than on the possibility of a military alliance. The Tsar even proposed to her once, and during his later reign asked for a guarantee to be granted asylum in England should his rule be jeopardised. And there is a long history of alliance, actually, between Russia and England. And we also have Muslims here. Trade and diplomatic relations developed between England and the Barbary states during the rule of Elizabeth, based upon the dictum that the enemy of my enemy is my friend. England established a trading relationship with Morocco in opposition to Spain, selling armour, ammunition, timber and metal in exchange for Moroccan sugar, in spite of a papal ban. Diplomatic relations were also established with the Ottoman Empire, with the chartering of the Levant Company and the dispatch of the first English ambassador to the port, William Harborne, in 1578. For the first time, a treaty of commerce was signed in 1580. Numerous envoys were dispatched in both directions, and epistolar exchanges occurred between Elizabeth and Sultan Murad III. In one correspondence, Murad entertained the notion that Islam and Protestantism had much more in common than either did with Roman Catholicism, as both rejected the worship of idols, and he argued for an alliance between England and the Ottoman Empire. To the dismay of Catholic Europe, England exported tin and lead for cannon casting and ammunition to the Ottoman Empire, and Elizabeth seriously discussed joint military operations with Murad III during the outbreak of war with Spain in 1585, as Francis Walsingham was lobbying for a direct Ottoman military involvement against the common Spanish enemy. So what we see here is even back then they were using proxy armies and trying to make alliances with other countries that were at odds with the countries that we were at war with, rather like funding Ukraine to go against Russia at the moment, funding ISIS to go against Syria, funding the moderate rebels, I guess, to go against Libya. And this was going on all the way back then. Trying to get on side with the Muslims, and I guess this alliance would have continued because by the time you get into the later British Empire, and General Gordon, he was working for the Ottomans at some point, wasn't he? And I'm not sure when the slavery was going on. I mean, this could when England was allied with the Ottomans here and with the Barbary states. I do think this is around about the time that we had those states were going to Europe and snatching people off the coasts and taking them back as slaves. Slavery going on at this time. So not much loyalty to the other Europeans there from Elizabeth.
Yeah, it seems to be a very volatile situation without anybody pursuing any kind of grand strategy, doesn't it? Apart from sort of just fighting with your immediate neighbour and looking the other side of your immediate neighbour to see if there's somebody else that you can link up with that will attack them from the other side. It's a bit disappointing, really.
Yeah, not very well developed. And of course, you've also got to remember that she's a woman, and she does say that. She says, I'm just a woman, but I will do my best at these sort of manly things. And she didn't do too well. I mean, the country did not get invaded, and we defended ourselves against the Armada. So she didn't do too badly. Thank you very much for listening, and watch out for part 2 of our Greatest Britain series on Elizabeth I.